Chapter 17. While the Princess Cecile continued to orbit 80 miles above Morzanga, Daniel locked the frozen image of the village adjacent to their intended landing place on his display, then increased the magnification to where he could see the poles supporting the individual houses. A central circle contained about half the 58 dwellings, and the remainder straggled away into the jungle in several directions. Natives walked among the houses and tended fish wares in the broad, mud-brown river nearby. A border of jungle concealed the village from anyone in the channel, but the weirs were a dead giveaway to its presence. According to Commander Bergen's logs, he landed on the RCS Granite in the slough just east of this village, Daniel said. Even exploration vessels like the Granite didn't land in moving water if they could avoid it. Besides, landing directly in the river would destroy the weirs and very possibly incinerate some fishermen as well. Not a good way to make friends of the locals. It doesn't appear to have changed in the 27 years since the Granite landed. Now you'll notice here, he was speaking to the Klimovs, but he suspected half the crew was listening to his exposition. The riggers had come aboard after they retracted the antennas and stowed the sails, and so long as the Sissy was orbiting the power room, technicians had nothing to do but watch gauges, which didn't flicker more than an eyelash from a flat response. The jungle is unbroken, Daniel continued, sliding to another portion of the main image. When we scan for magnetic anomalies, however, we get this. He cut in a cylindrical overlay, which a ragged shadow spraying out to one long side where a crash had thrown debris. As with the optical image, the software had sharpened this considerably, though in a fashion that only an expert would recognize. Uncle Stacy, Commander Bergen, that is, noted this wreckage in his log, but he didn't bother to explore it. His orders were to chart a course through the cul-de-sac in which Morzanga lies, and from the anomaly's dimensions, he assumed that the ship had been a Commonwealth vessel. They're known to trade in the region occasionally, and no doubt to raid as well. Daniel cleared his throat. Now, the chances are the wreck is a Commonwealth ship, but it might just possibly be the yacht on which your John Tsitsis escaped. There's no way to tell without examining it on the ground, but that should be easy enough to accomplish.
What do you mean by cul-de-sac? Space is space, not so?
From the first, the Klimova had been the one to take an interest in the working of the ship. Her husband was good enough company, but he spent his time either drinking alone or playing cards for rice grains with Hogg. To Daniel's amazement, Hogg barely held his own. According to him, the Count's real edge came from equipment that allowed him to deceive sharpers who cheated with electronic aids. By spoofing their hardware, Klimov's natural skill allowed him to clean them out when they bet on what they thought was a sure thing. No, madame, Daniel said. The miniature of the Klimona's face at the top of his display frowned at the formality, but her question had put him unconsciously into lecture mode. If it were, we wouldn't be able to travel between stars. Each bubble universe within the matrix has different physical constants. The only universal constant is the pressure of Casimir radiation, which we use to drive our vessel. By entering bubbles where time and space vary in known fashions, we're able to adjust our position relative to objects in the sidereal universe when we return to it.
Yes, Danny. What does that have to do with a cul-de-sac or whatever? Does your matrix have walls in it or something?
A ghost image of Adele frowning flashed into Daniel's display. She didn't speak, but her stern visage warned him to remember who he was speaking to. Not even his signals officer should have been able to crash the barriers onto a command console. In all likelihood, no other signals officer could have. Daniel grinned, a conscious expression, but an honest one as well. Imagine her warning him not to show proper deference. And being right, of course, a fine example of do as I say, not as I do. Aloud, Daniel continued, "There's no brick wall, no, but there are locations in the sidereal universe where the energy levels of the interpenetrating bubbles are so high that the gradients would damage or destroy a ship which tried to enter them. This arm of the galaxy is such a location, a cul-de-sac." He grinned more broadly, glad as he always was to be able to brag about Uncle Stacy's skill. Now, in fact, Commander Bergen did find a way through the bottom of the sack, so to speak, but it was a wormhole that very few astrogators could con even with the benefit of his logs. As a practical matter, traffic to Morzanga could have been come by way of Tegeli at the mouth of the sack. I doubt there's more than a ship or two in a generation. John Tsitsis was a space captain himself before he and his mercenaries hired themselves to our planet and seized the government, Count Klimov said. A tyrant and a thief, but a great captain. Perhaps he found the passage out the other way before your Commander Bergen did, eh?
Perhaps he did, Your Excellency, Daniel said. All we know at this point is that Tsitsis did return by way of Tegeli, because there'd be record of his reappearance there if he had. Daniel had been hot-tempered when he was a boy. Indeed, he still was when it was a matter of himself as a private person. But a junior officer in the RCN gets a great deal of experience in biting his tongue when those higher on the chain of command make stupid or even insulting statements, and the experience stood him in good stead now. Adele inserted her image at the top of Daniel's display, joining the conversation formally. She kept the image slightly smaller than the Klimov's and washed it out so that it was almost monochrome. "Captain Leary," she said obsequiously, "might Cissies have tried to reach the Commonwealth by the route Commander Bergen later found, but miscalculated and destroyed his ship in the process? If he'd gotten through, I think there'd have been some mention of him in the files I was able to copy in San Juan. As it is, there's no record of John Cissies after he landed on Tagelli, and nobody knew about that landing until you uncovered the artifacts at Pansuela House." "I agree that's a possibility, Mundy," Daniel said, feeling himself relax as Adele spoke. "I'll continue to hope that the Nicator crashed on Morzanga, though. If it disintegrated in the Matrix, I'm afraid there's no hope of ever recovering the Earth Diamond." "Then set us down, Captain," the Count said with a wave of his hand. "By all means, set us down and we'll search the wreck and all hope. But for myself, diamonds are sturdy things, that is so. But I fear that a crashing starship would break even a diamond into little bits."
"Adele," Daniel called over her helmet intercom, "we're about to receive a deputation from the village. Unless you're doing something particularly important, why don't you join us on the shore?"
"I'm on my way," Adele said, closing up her data unit and slipping the control wands into their sockets. "There's nothing on this planet's RF band except thunderstorms."
She walked to the companionway as she stowed the data unit, wobbling for the first few steps. She'd been sitting for a long time. In a way, Adele's determined search for radio transmissions was a failure because she hadn't turned anything up. On the other hand, it was important to know the crew of the Princess Cecile were the only civilized people on Morzanga. Adele smiled faintly. Her mother would have objected to the term civilized people because it implied that the natives of Morzanga were something else. They were something else. Uncivilized was a description, not an insult. The natives of Morzanga didn't live in a technologically advanced civilization like the one whose officials had shot her mother dead and staked her head onto Speaker's Rock in Xenos. Though the Morzangans probably had their equivalent, they were human, after all. The Corvette was open to vent the recycled waste of 10 days in space. Crewmen had locked automatic impellers capable of throwing streams of half-ounce slugs into the access ports on both sides of A-deck and at the cargo hatches on C-deck. The forward turret was raised. Its twin plasma cannon were trained toward the village just out of sight to the west. The gun crews looked tense. Not frightened, nothing like frightened, but very grimly prepared to turn everything within a mile of the ship into a shattered wasteland. The squad on the watch in the access hatch had similar expressions, holding their weapons instead of carrying them slung or leaning them against the bulkheads. They nodded as Adele stepped past. Tovera carried her miniature submachine gun openly instead of concealed in her attaché case. She followed Adele onto the boarding bridge over the slough whose waters had absorbed the blast of the starship's landing.
"I feel underdressed," she murmured, nodding to the spacers holding stocked impellers and full-size submachine guns. Occasionally she chose to demonstrate that she had a sense of humor.
"I doubt it'll be that sort of party," said Adele, resisting the impulse to hold her arms out for balance. The bridge was a full meter wide, and though footsteps made it quiver, Adele knew it was stressed for 3-ton loads. "If it is, I'm sure they'll make allowances for us." Some of the Cissies were good shots, and a few were excellent. The picked detachment of 20 waiting on the shore with Daniel and the Klimovs could withstand the attack of hundreds of Morzangans armed with bows and spears. But nobody on the Princess Cecile was Tovera's equal with a pistol, unless it was Adele herself. And as she said, that shouldn't matter today. Crewmen had unloaded the air car where Adele sat at her console. She hadn't seen it since Barnes flew staggeringly back to the Sissy in San Juan, barely able to stay airborne, carrying the Count and three of the worst injured spacers. Nobody'd mistake the vehicle for new, but the dents were hammered out and the twisted fan blades replaced. Barnes stood beside the driver's seat again. His friend Dossie was across the vehicle from him. Both cradled stocked impellers and were eyeing the vegetation 50 yards inland where the ground was dry enough to support sizable trees. Most of the other spacers were looking that way, too. "There's 6 men with spears at the edge of the jungle," Tovera said in a low voice.
"They're watching us."
"I'll take your word for it," Adele said as she joined Daniel.
"With your permission, Your Excellency," Daniel said to Klimov, "I'll walk toward them alone. They're probably afraid to come out in the face of your weapons. Hog, hold us, if you will." The Count didn't even bother to shrug assent to what was obviously a pro forma request. Daniel offered Hogg his stocked impeller.
"Like hell you're going without me," Hogg snapped.
He held out his own weapon to the nearest spacer.
"Here, Castro, hold this for a bit while me and the Master prove we're bloody heroes."
"I'll go with the Lieutenant, Hogg," Adele said quietly. "You can cover us from here." Hogg opened his mouth to protest, then closed it to a grin.
"Yeah, I guess there's nothing I can do with a knife that you can't handle your own way, eh, Tavera?"
Tavera shrugged. Her smile could have cut glass. "I'm glad to have your company, Mundy," Daniel said with a grin that melted the public formality of the words. "It's always reassuring to know that whatever information I need will be immediately available." They stepped forward side by side. Near the ship, plasma had seared the ground cover into a twisted mat over mud, which had dried to a crust. It bore Adele's weight, but Daniel repeatedly broke through and splashed his boots and trouser legs.
"This is awkward going," he murmured. "But by landing in the slough, I didn't risk the reflected exhaust flipping us over on our backs as I would on dry land. I think of the mud as one of life's minor trade-offs."
"I don't mind the mud," Adele said. "But nobody else aboard is afraid you'd botch the landing, so I don't see why you should be."
Perhaps so that nobody else has reason to be afraid," Daniel said.
He raised his left arm, palm forward, and waved to the brush 20 yards away. Trees more than 100 feet tall rose in a green-black backdrop slightly farther inland.
"Good day, gentlemen. We're visitors from Cinnabar, and we hope you'll accept gifts from us in return for our intrusion."
"Do they have atlatls?" Adele asked in an undertone. "Spear throwers, that is."
"Uncle Stacy didn't say anything about that," Daniel replied, "but of course it wasn't the sort of thing that interested him. Mind, we're far too close ourselves for that to matter."
A lanky man, nearly 7 feet tall, rose from the brush. He wore only a feather breech clout, but for a moment Adele mistook his tattoos for a woven garment covering his torso from neck to elbows. His spear was made from a thin, joined reed. Adele noted with a flush of pleasure that it was fitted into a knob stick whose leverage would be more than double the cast possible with an unaided arm.
"What gifts?" the man demanded.
He spoke universal, the pre-hiatus trade language, with a thick but intelligible accent. Where he wasn't tattooed, his skin was startlingly white, and his red hair didn't seem to be dyed.
"Do you have slash?"
"Indeed, we'll give you enough slash that your whole village can drink yourselves into a stupor," Daniel said, continuing to walk forward till he and Adele were only 6 feet from the brush. "But we'll do that as we're leaving, sir, so there won't be any awkwardness. Though, if you're the chief of your village, we'd be more than happy to offer you a taste of something now."
Even this close, Adele couldn't see the 5 other natives Tavera had mentioned. Well, Tavera would be at a loss to find a snatch of pre-hiatus poetry. Adele consciously avoided a grimace. Slash, homemade liquor, was as much part of star travel as Casimir radiation, and equally necessary, many spacers would have claimed. Anything organic can be fermented. Anything fermented can be distilled into liquor strong enough that you might be able to get drunk before nausea emptied your gorge. Adele had never found an attraction in numbing her mind, and even if she had, she'd still have been unwilling to use slash for the purpose. In this, however, she realized she was in the minority of those aboard the Princess Cecile. The native hesitated, his eyes flickering to his left. Another man of similar build, but much older, rose from a twisted bush close enough for Adele to have touched him. 4 more men of intermediate age stood up also. It was as if they coalesced out of thin air.
"I am the captain," said the oldest native emphatically.
The flint point of his spear was bound to the shaft with copper wire, the only metal Adele saw among the 6 of them.
"He's only the purser, and that because the lieutenant died yesterday and the purser was promoted to engineer, you must give me the slash."
A burly man, stocky only in comparison with his fellows, nodded enthusiastically. In addition to his spear, he carried a stone axe whose head with a little imagination resembled an adjustable wrench.
"Indeed we will, Captain," said Daniel, his voice formally portentous. "For you, and some for your officers, too, then. We'd be pleased to have you accompany us on a visit to the wrecked ship nearby."
He gestured toward the Princess Cecile, bowed to the captain, and turned. As he started back with Adele beside him, Daniel whispered, "Because if he's with us, I'll worry less about his friends suddenly deciding that they might get their slash quicker if they grab some of us for ransom."